You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. This is a reading of a cycle of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled Soul Economy and Waldorf Education. It is Collected Works Volume Number 303 and translated by Roland Everett. This is Lecture 11. Given in Dornach on the 2nd of January, 1922. At the end of yesterday's lecture, I tried to speak to you about the development of memory during the early school years. If we now look at the attitude regarding this question, as shown by most contemporary educational theorists, we cannot but notice a total lack of awareness of how certain impulses in the early years of pupils continue to play into their later lives, and how these then reappear in a transformed condition. This, at any rate, is what a true knowledge of man reveals to us. What so often happens nowadays is that the adult, when he tries to understand the ways of his own physical organism and of his psyche, reaches certain conclusions. Although he may not be conscious of it, he then assumes that these conclusions also apply to the varying ages and stages of childhood. Such an attitude, however, is very misleading, for, as I pointed out already, the forces working throughout the child's development need to be recognized and supported if our education is to be sound. We must meet the inner needs of the child, as the example of the importance of authority in the life of a young child was meant to convey. Let us take a hypothetical example of someone who in his 40th year undergoes certain vague soul experiences. Outer circumstances may suddenly shed light upon what has thus arisen in his soul. He may recognize that what was in his mind was something which, at the age of 8 or 9, he had accepted simply on the authority of a beloved teacher. At such a tender age, he could only entrust it to his memory, for the maturity of a 40-year-old person may have been necessary for its full comprehension. I say this, although not many people will believe my interpretation. However, children cannot always wait until they are 40 before they understand what they may have been told at the age of 8. And this is the very reason why they have an inner longing for authority. And when, at the age of 40, a new light suddenly flashes upon what had been accepted merely on the basis of authority at the age of 8, this happening brings an experience of new inner life forces which have a refreshing effect upon the entire person. New inner strength, badly needed in later life, is developed through such a process. And if one has accepted on authority plenty of content which, through outer circumstances, will reappear, as if by magic, out of one's organism, one is blessed with a revitalizing source of strength for the remaining years of one's life. Nowadays, many people age prematurely, both in body and in soul, because they are denied access to this vivifying force. Too many years have gone by since memory, during the early school years, was systematically strengthened through right and reasonable methods, and since it was based upon faith and belief in the authority of an adult. Memory training apart, there are always plenty of other opportunities for cultivating the children's faculties of comprehension, as I mentioned yesterday. But between the change of teeth and puberty, it is absolutely essential for teachers to work out well thought-out and sensible methods for developing the pupil's memory, because without this aid they will be deprived of too much in their later lives. If my intention were to please my listeners, I should have to speak quite differently about many things. But I wish to convey only what a true knowledge of man has revealed after decades of anthroposophical research. Consequently, many things I have to say will sound paradoxical when compared with currently accepted opinions. Some of my findings will create an impression of being old-fashioned, while others may appear, in quotes, avant-garde. But all this is quite unimportant. The only thing that matters is whether what I have to say will stand the test of a real knowledge of man. If one examines the general picture of man, as seen by so many people today, one can't help feeling that it has been arrived at by observing the human being from the outside only. It is as if one were trying to understand how a clock works merely by looking at it from the outside. In this way, one can read the time. One can recognize whether a watch is made of gold or silver. But one will never learn to become a clockmaker. What today goes under the name of biology, physiology, or anatomy shows us only what man is like when viewed externally. Human nature will become transparent to our understanding only if we learn to penetrate man's body, soul, and spirit. Only by including these three members in our investigations are we in a position to treat the human being in accordance with his real nature. And if, with insight into the whole human being, we now look at a certain question, lately much discussed in educational circles, it is the question of fatigue in the child's organism, we have to say the following. Experiments are being made today to establish the causes of fatigue or tiredness in children. The results of these investigations are then made use of in new teaching techniques, which aim at reducing strain in pupils. This sort of thing is done all over the world, and yet the whole question is based upon the wrong premise. A real knowledge of man would never lead to such a question at all. You only need to consider something which has been pointed out here during our last few meetings in order to find it so. You will remember that a strong plea was made repeatedly that all teaching during the younger years should appeal to the rhythmical and musical element in children, which first and foremost works upon their breathing and blood circulation. And now I ask you, can the source of fatigue ever lie in the children's breathing and blood circulation? Can it ever lie in the middle region of the human being, in the very region to which we always give our special attention and treatment during the child's school age? Never. For don't we all breathe continuously, both during sleep and waking life, from the moment we are born until we die, without ever feeling tired of breathing? Does not our blood circulate tirelessly from birth to death? Never is its flow interrupted through fatigue, for if this were to happen, the consequences would be serious indeed. Does this not show that teachers, working out of a real art of education, are constantly appealing to the very organs which are never subject to fatigue? This whole question has to be considered from quite a different angle. We must formulate it differently and ask, where do the real sources of tiredness lie in the human being? We find them in the head region and in the limb system. It is to these two systems we have to turn our attention if we wish to understand the nature of tiredness in children, which, according to whether it emanates from the head or from the limbs and metabolism, bears a completely different character. The forces working from the head downward into the remaining human organism deposit a very fine metabolic residue which wants to permeate the whole human body with fine salt-like deposits. This process, which affects also the breathing and blood circulation, is the cause of fatigue because of the head's direct contact with the external world and because of its arrhythmical and non-musical relationship with the outer world. The rhythms of breathing and blood circulation, on the other hand, are so strongly bound to the human organism that they retain a state of equilibrium, obeying their own laws. And what in the middle system acts like a self-contained unit is not subject to fatigue, at least not to any marked degree. It is, of course, possible to damage the inner rhythms of both children and adults by a wrong kind of treatment. But there is one thing we may be sure of, and that is that the rhythmic system, which is of such primary importance in any true art of education, never suffers from tiredness or fatigue. The limbs and metabolism, like the head, do get tired. You can observe this by watching a snake after it has eaten. The limb and metabolic system tires, or at least it can become a source of tiredness, affecting the whole human being. Yet this form of tiredness is of a totally different kind from that of the head. The head system causes tiredness through depositing salts, through a precipitation of mineral substances in the human organism. The limb and metabolic system, on the other hand, always has the tendency to dissolve physical substances through its creation of warmth. Here, too, despite its polar opposite effect from that of the head, the cause of tiredness is to be found in the comparative independence of this system from the inner rhythms of the human organization. This tiredness stems from the limbs' activities in the external world and from the metabolisms responding to the intake of food. Eating and drinking usually happen at irregular intervals, for there are only very few people who adhere to a strict and fixed rhythm of eating and drinking. Therefore, though both head and metabolism share the same cause of tiredness, their effects are of a polar opposite nature. What follows from all this? The whole question of fatigue in pupils needs to be put differently. If the child tires easily, we ought to ask, what is it we have done wrongly? Where do our mistakes lie? For we have no right to assume that our teaching methods are always correct. As long as we proceed by testing the child's liability to make so and so many errors per line after half an hour of writing than before, as long as we check its lack of awareness of meaningless words inserted in the text after a certain time of reading, we shall never reach human nature. This we shall do only by asking the right question, which in the case of fatigue in children should be, have I overburdened either the child's head or its limb system? We must find ways of not placing too much strain upon either of these two systems. However, it would be erroneous to believe that this could be achieved simply by adjusting the sequence of lessons in the timetable, for neither will gym lessons in themselves balance out too much headwork, nor, conversely, would arithmetic lessons directly work into the metabolism, though they do so indirectly. It is not possible to achieve the right balance merely by readjusting the timetable, but only by an artistic presentation of all lesson content, at least during the early school years. This in turn means that we have to appeal, in the way I have indicated, above all to the rhythmic system, the one system of the human being that never tires. When doing so, we also involve the other two systems, that of the head and the metabolic and limb system, in the activity of learning. Naturally, this needs to be done in the right way. I hope that by now you may have realized that certain doubts with regard to new ideas and methods of education, so frequently expressed by people who are prejudiced, do not apply to Waldorf education at all, because in every respect it is founded upon a true knowledge of man. And as it also endeavors to shed light upon man's soul and spiritual nature, it is able to lay the foundations of educational methods which will work upon the entire human being. And so, to give an example, it is important to recognize that the head system of man is the bearer of forces which, most strongly during childhood and to a lessening degree during successive ages, penetrate the entire human organism, shaping it, forming it, and giving it strength. What is working as a thought-directing capacity in the head is something which the human being, with all his predispositions, brings with him into this world at birth or conception. Eventually, these forces take on the task of forming the entire human being. If the head were not in direct touch with the external world, and if, in consequence, the inner rhythms of the human being were not disturbed all the time, then, if I may express it in this way, what has incarnated at birth in the head would be fully satisfied with the physical organization of man. The human being would flow into his physical organization, which would claim his entire being. He would be completely absorbed by it. He would not be able to make any contact with the supersensible world. As man would thus become separated from the spiritual world, his inner life would become more and more artificial and false. And, conversely, if through his limb and metabolic system, man would not be in constant touch with the external world, he would not be able to permeate with glowing warmth what is streaming down from the head. He would be unable to counteract these forces which would be working toward a more and more artificial state of perfection. Here we have two marked polarities. The head always wants to cut us off from the spiritual world by shaping our body in a way which would prevent us from gaining a right relationship to the spiritual world. For the head, with all that belongs to it, has completed its development a long time ago, during man's pre-earthly existence. In the process of materialization, issuing from the head, always has to be counteracted by the activities of man's metabolism and limbs, which stream upward from below. In this way, a balance is achieved in our corporeality. And between these two poles, as our middle system, like an organism complete in itself, there lies our respiration and blood circulation, our rhythmic system. This rhythmic system is like a separate world in itself, like a real microcosm. However, despite its comparative independence, it must be protected from extreme influences coming from the head, as can happen under certain circumstances, when the lungs become invaded by all kinds of foreign organic processes. This we can observe in the hardening of lungs, in new growth in the lungs of people suffering from lung diseases. Man needs this polarity between the head on the one side and the metabolism and limb systems on the other. The latter is always trying to dissolve the hardening processes issuing from the head, and this situation can be utilized also medically. For if one recognizes the interplay between what descends from the head and what ascends from the metabolism, one is able to cure, for example, pathological symptoms in the larynx, the trachea, or also in the lungs, by treating the metabolic system, even if the source of illness lies in the head. Especially in the case of children's diseases, quite spectacular results have been achieved by treating a patient's metabolism for the symptoms of illness which appeared in the head organization. The human being is one organic entity and has to be treated accordingly. This rule applies to all aspects of man, not only to a well-founded therapy, but especially to the field of education. If you look at the great progress in general knowledge made during the last centuries, it becomes very noticeable how little has been achieved with regard to knowledge of man. This is mainly due to the fact that the methods applied look into consideration, took into consideration only the physical, the external aspect of man. It really is of utmost importance for anyone engaged in the art of education to be able to recognize quite realistically what is happening in the body, soul, and spirit of the growing child, especially during the time which falls between the great turning point at 9+ and the coming of puberty. It is essential for the educator to be able to see how the physical, soul, and spiritual forces work upon and affect each other in the child he is dealing with. If with real insight we observe a child aged 9 to 10, we shall find that everything that enters its soul is absorbed and transmuted in such a way that the muscular system, permeated by forces of growth, becomes actively involved. At that time of life, the muscular system always responds to and cooperates with the soul nature of the child, especially where the most intimate forces of growth are at work. The interior swelling or stretching of the muscles mainly depends upon the development of the child's soul forces. And the characteristic feature of the age between 10 to 12 consists in the muscles having a specially intimate relationship with respiration and blood circulation. They are attuned to the middle system of breathing and blood circulation. And as Waldorf education appeals so strongly to this very part of the child's being, we indirectly promote the growth and development of the child's muscles. Toward the 12th year, a new situation arises. The muscles no longer remain so intimately connected with the child's respiration and blood circulation. They now incline more toward the bony system, adapting themselves to the dynamics of the skeleton. Their forces of growth are fully engaged in the movement of limbs, in walking, jumping, and grasping, in fact, in all limb activities in their relation to the skeleton. The muscles, previously closely allied to the rhythmic system, now become entirely oriented toward the bony system. In this way, the child adapts itself more strongly to the external world than was the case before the 12th year. Formerly, the muscular system was more directly connected with the child's inner being, and the rhythmic system, because of its relative independence, played a dominant part in the growth of the muscles. The child moved in harmony with the muscular system. And the skeleton, embedded in the muscles, was simply carried along. Now, toward the 12th year, the situation changes rapidly. The muscular system begins to serve the mechanics and the dynamics of the bony system. Everyone who is able to observe and understand what is happening within the child, now before the 12th year, Everyone who is able to observe and understand what is happening within the child, how, before the 12th year, the child uses its muscles, which simply carry the bones along, and how afterward it begins to relate itself directly to the skeleton, and in doing so also to the external world, has really gained a deep insight into the development of human nature. Such insights free us from abstract and intellectual modes of investigation so prevalent today, which so easily creep into the field of education. These insights also help the educator toward a truly human approach to the child. If one allowed such things to work upon one's soul, one would never impose the kind of treatment on a child such as Marcias had to endure. It is, of course, possible that some people are frightened off when they witness how transparent the human being becomes in the light of this kind of knowledge of man. They may well feel that the human soul is being dissected, but this is not the case, for the anthroposophical approach is both artistic and at the same time a deed of knowledge. The whole way of looking upon man is an artistic one. And it is this quality which is necessary if one wants to grasp the significance of the child's stage up to puberty, or, as we can now describe it, the transition from the intimate affinity of the muscles to the breathing and blood circulation up to the 12th year, and the subsequent kinship of the muscles to the bones from the 12th year to the coming of puberty. Can you see now how the incarnating human being gradually adapts himself to the world? In the very young child, the formative forces are centered in the brain. They ray out from the head. Then the center of activities shifts to the muscular system. And after the age of 12, the human being pours himself into the skeleton, as it were. Only then is he ready to enter the world fully. The incarnating human being first must penetrate the body before he can establish a relationship with the external world. First, the forces of the head are at work. Later on, these forces are poured into the muscles, then into the bony system, and after sexual maturity is reached, the adolescent is able to enter the world. Only then can he stand properly in the world. This gradual process of incarnation needs to be taken into consideration if one wants to find the right choice and presentation of subject matter, especially for this age. But unfortunately, nowadays, educators are hardly blessed with a sound knowledge of man. And now I must ask you to forgive me if I confront you with something which may appear to you completely absurd. Often I feel compelled to do such a thing, because I have to stand up for anthroposophical truths. Contemporary physiologists, biologists, and anatomists will look upon what I am going to say as pure heresy, but nevertheless, it represents the truth. When people speak or think about the human being today, they first of all turn their attention to the head. Although the head, in itself, always has the tendency to push us into what is material, although it would want to kill us every day if it were given free rein, it has nevertheless become the focus of attention among the general public of today. And this is what is so unhealthy in our present evaluation of the human being. It is the natural consequence of our modern scientific outlook. The general idea is that in the head there is the brain, which is a kind of absolute ruler over everything we think or do. I wonder how such a theory could have been explained before the time of the telegraph, for this invention offered such a plausible analogy to what is happening in our brain. However, this need not concern us here. The theory of the human nervous system was postulated only after the use of telecommunications had made such an analogy possible. And so the brain was compared to a telecommunication center stationed, let us say, in London, here Rudolf Steiner made a drawing on the blackboard, close parenthesis. If this is the center in London, then there could be Oxford and Dover over there. If London is the center, then we could say, here is a line running from Oxford to London. And here in London, messages coming from Oxford are switched over to Dover. Under given circumstances, we could well imagine it to be like this. And now one imagines that the human brain functions in a similar way. The nerves go from the brain to the sense organs, where sense perception takes place, and this perception is conducted back to the brain. Here in the brain there is the central station, the human London. Then, so one imagines, there are the motor nerves which go from the brain to the organs of movement, where they bring about the will impulses of movement in accordance with the thoughts of the brain, which somehow are also part of such a will activity. Once such a theory has been thought out, one can present the relevant facts in such a way that they seem to substantiate it. Take any book on physiology, and in it you will find descriptions of how experiments are made in cutting nerves and of how various physical reactions in the human body lead to definite logical conclusions. Unless you have strong reservations from the outset, for all these things look so very plausible, everything seems to fit together beautifully. The only snag is that it does not stand up to what a penetrating knowledge of man has to say about it. There it is not acceptable. I will disregard the fact that anatomically the sensory nerves and the motor nerves are practically indistinguishable from one another. At most, the one kind is a little thicker than the other, but with regard to their structure, there is not really any significant difference between them. According to anthroposophical research, and this I can only indicate, as otherwise I should have to give whole lectures on anthroposophical physiology, both types of nerves are uniform organs. It is quite absurd to talk about two different kinds of nerves, about sensory and motor nerves. As both the element of sensation and that of will are omnipresent in the human soul, I leave everybody free to call these nerves sensory or motor nerves. But they must be recognized as being but one unified entity, for there is no essential difference between them. The difference lies entirely in the direction in which they function. The optic nerve, a sensory nerve, is open to the light impressions upon the eye, and what is happening at the periphery again affects another nerve, which present-day physiology calls a motor nerve. If now this other nerve goes from the brain to the remaining organism, its function is to perceive what is happening during physical movement. A correct treatment of tabes dorsalis would confirm this statement. Readers aside, not sure I'm pronouncing that right, spell it tabes, T-A-B-E-S, dorsalis, D-O-R-S-A-L-I-S. End of readers aside. It is the function of the so-called motor nerve to perceive the motor impulses, to perceive what is happening when physical movement takes place, but not to initiate them. Nerves, wherever they may be, are organs for transmitting impressions. The sensory nerves transmit external impressions, and the motor nerves internal impressions. There is but one kind of nerve. Only a scientific materialism could have invented the analogy of the nerves with the telegraphic system. Only a materialistic science could believe that apart from the nerves which transmit sense impressions during the process of perception, there must also be other nerves whose special function it is to initiate will impulses. This, however, is not the case. Will impulses have their origin in man's soul and spiritual domain. Here they begin and they work directly into the limb and metabolic system, but not via any other kind of nerves. Nerves which enter the metabolism and limbs only transmit the impressions of what a person is doing in response to soul and spiritual impulses. Through them, we perceive the consequences of soul, spiritual, will processes in the blood circulation, in the remaining metabolism, and also in the movement of the limbs. These we perceive. The so-called motor nerves do not initiate physical movement. They only allow us to perceive the consequences of our will impulses. Unless we are clear about these relationships, we will not come to a proper understanding of man. On the other hand, if you can see the truth of what I am saying, you will also appreciate why I have to insist on making such apparently paradoxical statements, for they are instrumental in showing how the soul and spiritual part of man always works upon the entire human being. Approximately up to the 12th year, the effects of what has just been described are found in muscular activity, which is so intensely bound up with the child's breathing and blood circulation. From the age of 12 until puberty, they are linked more to the forces working in the skeleton. This means that before the 12th year, the child perceives with its so-called motor nerves more what is living in the activity of its muscles, whereas after the 12th year, its perceptivity tends more toward the processes taking place between muscles and bones. If you now consider that in every process of thinking, something of a will nature is also involved, for when linking together or synthesizing certain mental images, or when separating or analyzing them from each other, one is also using will forces, you have to look for this will element in the appropriate region of the organism into which it works from out of the domain of the human soul and spirit. And the will forces involved in the process of thinking are connected with the organism in the way just described. Therefore, when entering the 12th year, the child develops the kind of thinking which in its will nature is taking place within the bones, within the dynamics of the skeleton. At this point of time, the important transition is taking place from the soft muscular system to the hard bony system, which, as I should like to put it, places itself into the world like an objective system of levers. And herein lies the heresy, the paradox, which I have to put before you. When a person thinks about something belonging to the external, inorganic nature, he does so primarily with his skeleton. Naturally, anyone used to the accepted ideas of present-day physiology is liable to laugh at such a statement, coming from someone living in Dornach, who maintains that when a man thinks abstractly, he does so with his bones. But this is how it is. It would be more comfortable for me not to proclaim it, but it must be said, because a correct knowledge of man is so necessary today. The thoughts in our brain are only the pictures of what is really going on during the process of thinking. The brain is only the instrument which produces the passive mental pictures of the real processes which are going on in the activity of thinking. In order to become conscious of our thinking, we need these mental pictures. But these images, which the brain reflects for us, lack the inner force inherent in pure thinking. They lack the element of will. The real nature of thinking has no more to do with the mental images produced by the brain than a picture of a certain Mr. X, which you may see hanging on a wall, has to do with the actual Mr. X himself. We must learn to distinguish the picture of a Mr. X from the real Mr. X. In the same way, the real process taking place during the activity of thinking must be distinguished from the mental images derived therefrom. When thinking is directed toward outer physical nature, the entire human organism is involved to a certain extent, but particularly so the bony system, the skeleton. And in the 12th year, the child's thinking enters the sphere of the skeleton. This is the signal for us to lead over from the teaching of subjects characterized yesterday, from the plant in its relation to the earth, and from the animal kingdom in relation to man, to a new range of subjects. Our awareness of what is happening in the soul and spiritual domain of the child must lead to the appropriate choice and planning of lesson content. The way in which the soft muscular system, with its kinship to respiration and blood circulation, plays its part, is an indication that the child from the 10th to the 12th year should be introduced to plants and animals in the way indicated. For these subjects are more directly related to the inner nature of man than the more distant subjects such as mineralogy, dynamics, physics, and so on. Therefore, at the approach of the 12th year, the teaching content, which previously had mainly a pictorial character, and which included the living plant and the sentient animal, should now appeal more to the intellectual grasp of inorganic nature. Only now the point is reached, when the young adolescent can place himself as an earthly being into the world of dynamics, of mechanics, and when he can experience their forces. Only now the possibility offers itself of introducing him to the first principles of physics and chemistry, which are subject to definite natural laws, and to a knowledge of what belongs to the realm of the mineral world. If these subjects are taught at an earlier age, one interferes with evolving human nature, unconsciously damaging the pupil's healthy development. The ability to grasp historical connections, to gain an overall view of historical developments with their underlying impulses and social implications, represents the other side of the stage at which the pupils are able to comprehend the physical and mineral aspects of life. Only toward the 12th year do they become mature enough for both of these aspects. For historical ideas and impulses which find outer expression in definite historical periods, and which directly affect social life and social forms, are like the skeleton of history. Although, when seen in a purely historical context, they can also be something quite different. The flesh, or the muscles, as it were, are represented by the historical personalities themselves, by their biographies, and also by concrete historical events. Therefore, if we have to introduce history already between the 10th and the 12th year, we must bring it in the form of pictures which engender warmth of feeling, and which inwardly uplift the pupils' souls. This is possible through telling the children of biographical events, and through characterizing certain concrete happenings which form a self-contained whole. But we must refrain from introducing abstract ideas and impulses underlying certain historical epochs. These the pupils should meet in their 12th year, which is the time when they begin to take their stand in the external world. Here again you can see how an inner development gradually extends in an outward direction. Only now is the pupil ready to grasp how historical impulses, manifesting in outer events, affect the lives of people. It is important to realize this, as otherwise there is always the danger of our approaching the child from an adult point of view. When dealing with the education of the young, it is all too easy to draw a parallel to an adult study of the sciences, where one begins with simpler content in physics and chemistry in order to move on gradually to more difficult parts. In a similar way, so one may think, should the subjects taught at school also be graded? But this is not in accordance with the child's nature. What to an adult appears to be the simplest content, such as we find it in the mineral kingdom and in the inorganic physical world, the child is able to grasp only when it has penetrated the sphere of its bony system, when it moves about in the external world according to the dynamics of the skeleton, as if it were obeying the laws of the lever. Many people today have become accustomed to looking at practically every aspect of life as if it ought to belong to the domain of natural laws. We find historians who try to interpret social phenomena accompanying historical impulses as if they too should be subservient to the laws of nature. This attitude is encouraged already in childhood if physical and chemical laws are taught before the 12th year, that is, before the other subjects, more closely allied to human life, are studied in lessons. If school subjects are introduced in their wrong order, pupils will project their own experiences and their understanding of purely physical laws also into the social sphere and into their understanding of history. And since such a way of looking at the world has already deeply penetrated educational practice, the general public is only too willing to look for natural laws operating in practically every sphere, so that one may no longer speak of historical impulses as having their origin directly in the spiritual world. And this in turn is again reflected in our present principles of education. The child is encouraged to develop such a firm belief in what it has been taught in physics and chemistry that later on, as an adult, he or she will carry this limited outlook into the entire world outlook. What I have written on the blackboard comes from America, quote, "Nature's proceedings in social phenomena," close quote. This phrase has become almost a slogan for an educational principle which postulates that the child should be educated in such a way that it will look upon processes in social life as if they were the results of natural laws. The child is to regard occurrences in the life of the community as mere processes of nature. People have come to me again and again to tell me that this phrase should read differently in English, that it should read, quote, "progress of nature," close quote, or something similar. However justified their criticism may be from the point of view of use of language, what matters is that the quotation in question has actually become a catchword for a definite principle in educational science. Whatever the correct wording may be, we must realize that its message needs to be corrected, and this is what I wish to do from a worldwide point of view. Merely correcting the wording is not good enough. For the meaning implies that one can find only natural laws working through social impulses, And this is the kind of attitude which we inculcate in our children. We must begin to experience natural laws working in the processes of nature and higher spiritual laws working within the social sphere. And this is not happening. We ruin our pupils' future world outlook if we introduce them prematurely to what belongs to chemistry, mineralogy, physics, dynamics, and so on. As I have pointed out so many times already, one has to keep an eye on the entire milieu of our culture in order to know where to promote the impulses of the art of education. Forgive me if once again I have raised an objection against what has become common practice, but in my opinion it is a justified objection. If one approaches present-day science with the knowledge and insight which can be gained by following the paths outlined in my book titled Knowledge of the Higher Worlds and Its Attainment, one is under the impression that the world as described by natural science, which explains everything in terms of mineral and physical laws only, is not a world in which we as human beings of flesh and blood can live. Theirs is a different world altogether. If one looks with eyes opened by imaginative knowledge at the kind of world described by exponents of modern natural science, and if one sees how their picture of the world is meant to affect the people of today, one cannot find any human beings of flesh and blood there at all. One sees only walking skeletons, only little bone men and bone women. Theirs is a strange world indeed. I once made an interesting experiment. The younger ones among you won't remember a certain Swiss philosopher called Vogt, known as Fat Vogt, a typical thinker of recent times, who in the 50s of the last century somehow managed to knock together a rough and ready materialistic world philosophy which, specter-like, still haunts all kinds of world views of today. Well, I tried to imagine what would happen if a real human being of flesh and blood were to find his way into this world of walking skeletons. Any healthy person of flesh and blood could not possibly bear to live in such a world. But what would happen, so I asked myself, if someone with at least a modicum of flesh and blood were to stray into this world of walking skeletons? The effects of living in a world as described by a purely materialistic outlook, and the intentional influences upon people emanating from it, would make such a person suffer from both neurasthenia and hysteria of the worst kind. He would never be able to free himself from all the influences surrounding him. Fundamentally speaking, natural science of today describes a world in which we all could become neurasthenic and hysterical. Mercifully, the world of the natural scientist is not the real world in which we live. Quite other forces, undreamt of by them, are at work in the real world. Nevertheless, it is necessary for us to extricate ourselves from this falsely uniform world of illusion, from which we take almost everything that contributes to the general civilization of today. We must reach a true and real knowledge of man, for only then will we be able to educate in the right way. The end of Lecture 11.